Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this Free CP 117. Welcome indeed. You find me at this moment sitting in my office, completely surrounded by shirts hanging on hangers, and that can mean only one thing. I'm just looking around now. There's one, two, three, four. There's actually nine of them hanging up. Why, you ask? Well, I'm off to the USA in a few days, and well, I'm a British gentleman, aren't I? When we travel smart. Of course, I will also be recording a number of interviews, so it would be better to not wear the same shirt in all of them. Anyway, I've got a really interesting one for you today. I would hazard a guess that this conversation takes you to a number of places that you have never been before. It certainly did for me. Scott Schneider, my guest, and I'm going to read you a bio I pulled off the web because it's interesting. Scott is a special counsel at International Aerospace Law and Policy Group, focusing on public international law, spacecraft insurance, and advocacy and approval frameworks for aerospace activities. He is previously the director of the Space Law Council of Australia and New Zealand, a current member of the International Institute of Space Law, and on the executive team for the Space Generation Advisory Council. Scott has also worked with the Space Industry Association of Australia and contributes to the International Space University in various capacities. He likes space, let's be honest here. He also teaches space entrepreneurship at university, which I find incredibly interesting. Anyway, the reason our paths crossed was because he also works at the Live and Let Live Foundation, if the other jobs in space weren't enough. He's their strategic advisor. The Live and Let Live movement seeks to eliminate aggression in all forms, promoting a philosophy of non-aggression and mutual respect as a path to improving the world. Got that off their website, obviously. But I'm on board with that. Let's see what the AI thought of our conversation. This episode explores the intersection of space law and personal freedom, delving into how legal structures can evolve alongside technological advancements in space exploration. The conversation covers the challenges and opportunities that arise from the current frameworks governing space activities, including the implication of property rights in outer space and the potential for private governance models. Scott shares insights into the growing space law community and emphasizes the importance of fostering discussions around innovative governance models that prioritize individual rights. It's a fascinating interview. Listeners will gain a deeper understanding of how the principles of freedom can be applied in the context of space and how movements like Live and Let Live are paving the way for a future where individuals can thrive alongside traditional governance structures. Correct, not bad, AI. But it missed a couple of things that blew my mind. Number one is our whole discussion about personal satellites and basically how easy and cheap it is to send your own satellite up into space and then start getting data from it. But also we talked a lot about the similarities between space and seasteading, which is something I've noticed for many years now. So you can draw your own conclusions about whether you think I'm right or not. Scott's obviously a bit of a perfectionist, and I need to read you something that he emailed me after our interview. It says, in inverted commas, "I think I made two errors during our conversation, which you may either want to address in post or indicate in the show notes." Well, I'm going to indicate it here. Number one, the size of one unit CubeSat is 10 centimeters, not 9 centimeters. Number two, the size of a Starlink satellite is quite a bit larger than the CubeSat unit at nearly 3 times 1.5 meters. Obviously, 1 centimeter means a lot in the aerospace world. I'm sure it does, but we were talking about CubeSats, which are these really tiny little personalized satellites, essentially, that you can have taken up into space. Anyway, Nostr comments from the past week, people who are adding to our strategic Bitcoin reserve, thank you very much. I'm just going to read them out from the wonderful Fountain app. Okay. Aaron says of Vera's episode last week, fascinating episode. I recall reading that though Odessa was outside of the SAR's proper reach, his secret police were nonetheless active on the ground. On the note of the Free City startups lacking soul, the Italian government was offering foreigners homes for $1 in Sardinia last year. I wonder if there's an opportunity to negotiate with a host nation on ghost towns where some architecture and history already exists. Absolutely is the answer to that. In fact, a few years ago, I started making a film about this exact subject in Bulgaria. We visited a number of deserted villages in the Rodopi Mountains. Some of them had just one old lady left living in them. But one of the interesting things that came up was that there were Bulgarians who had left for Europe to work, who were coming back to their home country and sort of repatriating these villages. Some of them were completely empty, and you could buy properties for 3,000 or 4,000 euros. One in particular was a tech hub, so they had a lot of tech people that got together and bought it, got a good satellite internet connection, and basically turned it back into a thriving place. So yes, these things can happen, and I wouldn't be surprised if they happen a lot more going forwards. Anyway, I could talk for hours on that. I won't now. Back to the comments. Hypno says, hang on about Alex Martinoff's episode, Mindfulness, Inner Freedom, and Connecting with Your True Self. We are hanging on. In fact, I'm more than hanging on. I've let go. I have absolutely let go. I'm fully in the flow now. Final one from user 795. Manuel Barkow's interview. Oh, Vera's wasn't last week. It was the week before. Manuel's was last week. Thanks for this pod. The Libertarian Party wasn't on my radar yet. Well, it is now. And that was the German Libertarian Party as well, which isn't on many people's radar. Anyway, don't forget the FCC. I love my acronyms, don't I? So does the Federal Communications Commission too, apparently. Anyway, the original FCC, the Free Cities Conference, has been declared for 31st of October to the 2nd of November. Oh, I get excited already just thinking about waking up on those crisp Prague mornings, grabbing a coffee and then just talking Free Cities all day. God, I love that conference. And long may it last. Right, time to dive into the convo. And this week, it goes out to all the people currently listening to this in their car. Sit back, relax, keep your eyes on the road, and enjoy my conversation with Scott Schneider. Scott, Live and Let Live Foundation. Let's hear your career path.
Yeah, that's right. So the Live and Let Live Foundation, my involvement there has been more of a recent project of mine. My background is in law, and my specialization is in aerospace law. And learning more about the international legal frameworks, which is what I do international aerospace law. So working out how national laws can conform with all the international legal frameworks if a company or a research organization is doing a space mission or building a new type of launch vehicle. And through learning more about the international legal systems that govern those types of activities, I've become much more aware about the scope of international law more broadly, and about how domestic laws are working on a national level as well. And so I had always had an inkling towards individual rights and being able to have voluntary exchanges and transactions on a community level, and understanding more about how the international legal frameworks operate and how they're functioning and how limiting they are for some individual rights made me be more focused on movements like the Live and Let Live Foundation, which is...
I mean, how do you hear about that, though? If being in an aerospace law and the Live and Let Live Foundation, which you better explain what it is first, but they don't seem to be that closely connected.
No, to be honest, it's quite a small world in the space law community, international space law community, and it's hard to find like-minded colleagues and peers who are thinking of alternative forms of governance to this state institution and in the international organization structure that we are currently all operating under. So I've made an effort to try and find outlets to connect with people and other organizations that do have those types of thought processes. And the Live and Let Live Foundation actually was, before it was an official foundation or a public charity, it was basically a discussion group between the two co-founders and some of their contacts. And I reached out to one of the co-founders, Mark Victor, who runs he's a lawyer also, and his law firm is called Attorneys for Freedom. And so he's very focused on individual rights from a criminal law perspective. And this was something that he was passionate about, and got together a group of people who also were passionate about individual rights and, you know, the non-aggression principle under legal frameworks or political institutions. And from that discussion group formed this public charity, which now has a mission to try and inspire other people and organizations to calibrate the laws that they're living under, that in a way that actually protects individual rights and promotes freedom and these types of things.
First thing to say is I love the fact there is a space law community.
Uh-huh.
I'm already interested. Yeah. Obviously, it's small, like you say, but at least there is a space law community.
There is one. It's important as well, particularly with a lot of the new types of activities and technologies that are being tested now, because it's a lot cheaper now to do some of the activities that were more traditionally done by states. And so you have a lot more of missions and new things that are being tried out in the space sector, and it's very important to make sure that, you know, if we're going to comply with the existing laws, what's the scope of flexibility within those frameworks that allow for these types of new technological developments?
Well, I mean, without putting too fine a point on it, the space is the final frontier, and actually frontiers are places of often lawless places. That's mm-hmm. the whole point of frontiers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We often talk about that on this podcast, the fact that freedom lovers always look to frontiers to create their utopias or to whatever.
Yeah, it is nice. There's some an analogy might be with the seafarers and the spacefarers, you know, a few centuries ago, something going into the unknown. But from my perspective, because I understand the space sector and what's happening there, for me, the final frontier seems more like what's happening in the cyber world, or because this is an unfamiliar world to me, how everything is connected and how this machine learning programs are working. And so from my perspective, because that's a field that I'm not an expert in, for me this seems like the final frontier.
Do you mean the digital realm?
Something like this, yeah. And whatever the capabilities of that realm are.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, from a legal perspective, it does throw up a lot of very, very interesting predicaments, like, is a murder in virtual reality a murder?
Uh-huh. Or about if you're committing a crime using some proxy or something like this, how many steps back are you able to actually figure out what happened? I mean, a lot of it is to do with privacy law. That's a big legal focus about the digital realm at the moment, is privacy. But like you say, there's all kinds of things that...
I mean, do they ever work this stuff out? I mean, you know, I predict, and have done for many years, that there will be versions of reality in our lifetimes that are indistinguishable from this, from you and I talking now, mm-hmm. somehow. Probably be one of Elon's things plugged into the back of your head or something. I don't know.
Like a synthetic dimension or something like this.
Well, a digital realm, uh-huh. which you interact with on a conscious level. consciousness level, literally. I mean, if you've ever taken hallucinogenic drugs, you know that you can look at things that aren't there, right?
Yeah.
That literally, according to what you understand about physical reality. So I'm pretty sure that you could conjure up a technology that allows you to interact with, you know, the internet the way we do now, but in a immersive way, completely immersive way. Now, at that point, it does throw up a lot of very, very interesting questions about law. Because are you actually suffering the consequences of actions in the same way that you are in real life? Arguably not. It depends how they if they bake it into the protocol.
That's right. Well, also, I mean, it might be something as simple as the property rights. Whatever you're doing in that realm is your property or your information or your content. And so if it's interfered with that way, maybe it's...
I think that probably would be at the base of it. And actually, I think that's the most interesting thing about space property rights, as far as I've had a few conversations about it before.
Good.
You know, I think most people who I've spoken to are kind of on the side of the kind of John Locke version of, if you go to Mars and you create something of value, it's yours.
Yeah.
Whereas, as far as the UN are concerned, I think they think that space belongs to everyone.
The UN is not following the Lockean perspective necessarily. Actually, when Walter Block co-authored a book called Space Capitalism, and he makes that point very clear, is that, and he emphasizes that point in a very colorful way, of course, but it's if you're reading the main space frameworks, the main one being the Outer Space Treaty, which is an instrument that was developed over the 1950s and came into effect in the 1960s. Yes, this has a very strong emphasis on non-appropriation by states of really anything to do in outer space, particularly with resources.
I suppose the question is, what can they do about it? Like, if you're Elon and you're on Mars and they're saying, stop doing that,
yeah,
he can just say, come and stop me.
Yeah, I guess it depends how many assets Elon would have still here on Earth that are vulnerable to,
I suppose, yeah,
seizing them or something like that. But yeah, if you were fully disconnected from you know, Earth's systems and your property wasn't connected here, the enforceability becomes an interesting question.
So where do you stand on that one then?
In
property rights in outer space.
Oh, well, it's, for me, there's a grey area between where the individuals can own property rights. And there's, I think, in four jurisdictions around the world, there are, the United States is one of them. They do recognise that you can have commercial transactions with resources from outer space.
So it's already baked. It's already, how old are these laws then?
The United States was the first to do it. And I have, if I'm remembering correctly, it was in 2015 when the legislation at least was passed. I'm not sure when it came into effect.
On what grounds? Like, why did they need that legislation?
Well, the United States did it to stimulate, you know, to make sure that, you know, the company, because resources are very important in space, not necessarily for things that we want to do here on Earth, but for in-space activities, fuel being one of them. And so having a law that guarantees the property rights for the companies that are experimenting with all these was important to try and, you know, facilitate those types of technologies. And so following them, I think, is United Arab Emirates and Japan. And the fourth, it's escaping me, but there is definitely a fourth country. But this is protecting the individual property rights. It's not state appropriation. And under the international law, the states can't appropriate the resources.
So if you fly to an asteroid and mine it for gold, it belongs to you. Is that basically what that says?
If you have the means to protect it, yes. Depending under which jurisdiction you mined the gold and whose national laws were applicable to you.
How does that work then? Is that something like seafaring law, when you have a flag? You can be under the Seychelles flag, but you're using their laws, but you're in the Panama Canal or whatever, you know.
In terms of registration, it's a little bit like that. So if you're doing a space mission, your spacecraft or your space object will need to be registered with a particular jurisdiction. And then that jurisdiction will be largely what determines what laws you need to comply with, so long as those laws are in compliance with the international treaty framework. But that's very different to an issue of liability, of which states become liable if things go wrong in outer space. So they're two related but very different implications about which state has responsibility for the legal jurisdiction compared to which state is actually liable for if anything goes wrong in outer space.
And what about claiming a whole asteroid as a sovereign object? That is outlawed by the United Nations or whatever treaty, is that right?
Yeah. The United Nations was essentially the forum where the treaty came, where this treaty was drafted. And again, I can't remember the exact number of states, but it's a majority of countries have signed on to this and ratified this. And even going beyond that, it would be considered most likely customary international law, which means that even the countries that haven't signed that treaty or ratified it into their domestic laws still obliged to comply with it. And then yes, there's an article in that treaty that says that states cannot appropriate an asteroid or a piece of the moon or something like this,
which is interesting really, because that's not kind of how it worked historically on the Earth, is it?
No, the context for all this was during the Cold War, and so the only states that had any space capabilities or any potentials to develop space capabilities was the USSR and United States. So there was somewhat of a mutual interest to try and agree on something that was going to make sure that one or the other wasn't going to be using space for aggressive purposes.
Or claiming the moon, probably.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah. Naturally, there's a separate treaty. There's really five main space treaties. There's the main one, which is the Outer Space Treaty, and then there are four somewhat supplementary treaties that expand on particular principles and provisions in the Outer Space Treaty. And one of those supplementary treaties is called the Moon Agreement, which is very focused on not having any military infrastructure on the moon and being able to be open to inspection for any other states to come in and look at what you're doing, and which is also a principle of the Outer Space Treaty. But interestingly, the Moon Agreement, which goes into more depth, has a very low signature rate from states. I think there might be 18, or it would be barely more than 20 states have signed on to the Moon Agreement, which is trying to emphasize that, you know, basically if you're on the moon, it's fair game. Anybody can come in and look at what you're doing. You have no secrets. You can't do any military outposts. So it wasn't very popular.
My God, I've never thought about any of this. What a fascinating subject. What do you think will actually transpire then? Because we're not that far away from all this stuff, right?
No, there's already an alternative. I'm not sure if it's correct to say it's an alternative, but it's let's say it's an interesting complementary framework, which is called the Artemis Accords. It's not strictly a treaty. It's more of an understanding that states are signing up to. It was led by the United States. I'm not an expert on these accords, but it's trying to be more specific about how we can use the moon, because the United States has this moon to Mars objective. And so it's very focused on the moon right now, and projects like the Lunar Gateway, you know, being able to have a permanent spacecraft that you can access the moon easily from Earth. And so they're very focused on making sure that this is not worth nothing, and that when they get to the moon, they'll be able to somehow use whatever they find there and be able to control. And so it was contentious when it was initially put forward back in 2020, because it can be interpreted as an alternative to the Moon Agreement. And the Moon Agreement, you know, came from the Outer Space Treaty and was supposed to be in good faith and making sure that, you know, everybody has an equal playing field. And so the Artemis Accords is already in my opinion, again, I'm not an expert on it, but it's a slight shift away from what the central principles of the Outer Space Treaty.
Are the Artemis Accords on a response to what Elon's doing or what NASA do?
How I see them is that it's to facilitate what NASA wants to do, or particularly what the United States wants to do from a geopolitical perspective, and NASA is one component of that. But there are, of course, genuine research and scientific interests there, but nothing's in a vacuum.
Do you know much about what SpaceX are kind of investigating in these terms? Legal structures, governance structures, I don't know. Because they are literally talking, their goal, right, is mm-hmm. to create colonies on Mars. Mm-hmm. So they'll need governance structures at least, won't they?
They would. I'm not sure what those projects, how they're discussing those ideas in turn, because I don't think there's any public forum that that Musk's project is inviting for these types of discussions. Well, at least I'm not familiar with one, but it would be surprising if there isn't one where those types of discussions are taking place. But again, it depends on the scope that he and his team are wanting to achieve, because if you are happy operating within your jurisdiction, it would be pretty easy to maintain the governance model of the United States or another country on a space habitat in Mars. The difficult thing is convincing the United Nations and the governments to say that, no, this is our own governance models. And to be honest, this was one of my personal interests in observing all these talks from the Liberty in Our Lifetime conference, when everybody is talking about free cities. For me, this is very interesting, because if there is a model that has proven to be sustainable here on Earth, there's little reason why those same fundamental frameworks couldn't be just then adapted to, you know, people who do want to do long-term space missions or live in outer space.
Well, I mean, personally, I think the free private city model works perfectly in that scenario. Mm-hmm. In the same way that, and you can see versions of that in Dubai. Dubai is not a democratic place. You don't move to Dubai to vote on how Dubai is run.
That's right.
You just move there to live, mm-hmm. and you use their product, which mm-hmm. is Dubai. Same with cruise liners, I think. They're another good example. Mm. Cruise liners are floating private cities. Mm-hmm. They have their own governance. They have a captain who's like a bit like a dictator. He even dresses like a dictator, uh-huh. doesn't he? You know, and you know, they have a prison on there, that he has rights over his crew and members there. They will sign a contract when they go on there,
right? Okay.
And then it takes off. Uh-huh. I mean, it's very similar to what I would imagine a space colony could do. It doesn't need to be a democratic system. It just needs to be a product that you choose to use or not, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never looked into it. I will do that now, because that's curious, that analogy. How I imagine cruise lines are is they're putting in their own rules beyond whatever flag they're flying under. So if it's a United States cruise ship, they'll still have to be complying with the United States laws.
Yes, but people flag their ships. No one flags their ship under the United States, right, as far as I know.
Reason.
Yeah. You'd flag it under the Cayman Islands or whatever. I don't know. Uh-huh. I mean, the guy to speak to about that is Joe Quirk.
Right.
He heads the Seasteading Institute. But, I mean, I just spoke to him yesterday for three hours, all about it on the podcast. And when he breaks it down for you, the model of the cruise liner is a very, very perfect living example of how a free private city would work, operate, with the added advantage that if your jurisdiction decides to shut you down, mm-hmm. you can literally sail away, mm-hmm. which makes it even better. I mean, it has this added advantage, which is why he's so passionate about seasteading, because he sees the idea of floating cities, which, just like going into space, mm-hmm. I mean, he would tell you that actually floating cities will come before Mars colonies, because they're easier, and they're much easier. Yeah. And people will use those. There'll be a stepping stone mm-hmm. to learn about what works and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. But they're very similar. Mm-hmm. I mean, but yeah, the cruise liner one, it's so perfect in so many ways, because it has all the characteristics of a private city. You even sign a contract.
I was gonna
when
say,
you
people
get
are actually knowing what they're getting into when they come on board.
There's a social contract, literally. And if you break that contract, the city provider, who is the captain, can actually put you in prison or kick you off the ship. Mm-hmm. This happens apparently relatively regularly. People get kicked off and left on ports because they're so disruptive within the community. Uh-huh. You know, like people get drunk and have fights or whatever. You know, like
that's interesting. I wonder if you can get insurance for those types of things.
Of course,
like,
if I get
kicked off a ship, am I going to get?
Oh, you as an individual?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Probably, but I don't know. I don't think it would be worth it. I mean, it's a very small outcome.
Depends how rowdy you're expecting to be on the cruise.
Yeah. Well, all that free food and stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
free free food and drink.
Yeah, you don't know what port they're going to leave you at, I guess. So.
Yeah. No, but it's after this. Last few conversations I've had with Joe, mm-hmm. I very much think of, you know, whenever I try and talk to people about free private cities, I will use that as the example. Mm. Because the other thing is, the beautiful thing about that model is when people walk onto a cruise liner, they don't think I'm walking onto into a private city. Mm-hmm. They don't think anything political. They don't think anything. All they're thinking about is, do I like this place? Yeah, and actually,
a good time.
Their standard of living is huge. If you compare it to a hotel on the land, you know, when you go on a cruise ship, it's basically for a similar price to, you know, you might pay in a nice hotel on the land, you might pay $200 a night.
Or for a resort or something.
Yeah, like right. Yeah. On a ship, you have pretty much personal staff. I mean, you know, the staff to customer ratio on a boat is incredible. It's such a high standard of living. It's like living as an aristocrat. Mm. Free food whenever you want it. Hundreds of restaurants, swimming pools, amusement parks, your own personal, you know, you can get room service. Uh-huh. It's like, you know, it proves the kind of private city model very well, i.e., if you do it this way, you get a higher standard of living for less money, and you don't really know about that. You don't care about the politics of cruise liners. Mm-hmm. You're not voting. You don't want to sit down and vote who runs the ship. Mm-hmm. You just care that the ship is run well, and if it's not, you complain, and if that doesn't work, you leave the ship and you go to another ship, because mm-hmm. there's hundreds of other ones you can choose from. It's the perfect model, you know.
Although I'm not sure how many business ventures are being registered on the cruise ship. That's a different dynamic, I wonder.
Well, you can do medical tourism on cruise liners now. Okay. I mean, obviously, all those things will arise if the market
dictates. Right, yeah, exactly. Foundations are there.
But there's one cruise ship called The World, which is full-time people that live just going from port to port. So you buy or long-term rent condos on this boat, and it just keeps going. And some people stay on there all year, and some people just go for a couple of months, but they own
it's amazing.
Well, yeah. Uh-huh. Dude, the super rich live like that. Mm-hmm. I have a friend, or someone I used to know at least, who was a private chef to one of the biggest private yachts in the world. And the story she used to tell me, those guys at that level just live from port to port, going around the world, completely off the grid.
Yep.
No rules, no, you know. So it's like I say, and those kind of things, the marginal cost of those things always comes down.
Because I was just thinking that I wonder the accessibility to people who aren't in that, you know.
Well, cruise liners. Uh-huh. They do now.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
you can go and live on a private yacht, all right, albeit you have to share it with other people, but the marginal cost is coming down.
Yeah, good.
And the marginal cost of floating cities will come down. Yeah. And then the marginal cost of space cities will eventually come down. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how will they operate? I just think that space is very similar to the sea.
There's a lot of analogies. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So I would imagine that the same kind of things could apply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, the interesting thing is working out what, I mean, for me, maybe one difference with outer space is I think the physiological effects that the body will experience from being in that type of environment. I would suspect that there is going to be different, you know, after maybe several generations, or even within a couple of generations, the value systems of humans will change quite drastically compared to most societies of humans living on Earth. In terms of, I guess my point is that I can envisage some outgrouping happening where people start identifying with their space colleagues or whoever they're living with on their long-term space mission or in their space habitat. And that's going to create an entirely different structure of, you know, what my priorities are. And if you have the Earth system trying to control the governance models and the frameworks and, you know, how we distribute, you know, how we're using your taxes or that you're giving us, I think that's just going to be a recipe for the space having individual free societies anyway, even if they're not developed like that in the beginning.
Yeah, I think that's 100% likely. Uh-huh. I'm thinking of the, even on Earth, moving to Dubai and living there, people quickly lose the association with their home country because they're going there for a reason. More often than not, they're going there because they find that it's better than their home country. Uh-huh. And sure, you know, family ties are hugely, hugely important. But what about that first generation when your children are born in Dubai? I mean, I live in a place I didn't grow up in. My children already now know that's home. Mm-hmm. So we're there, I'm there, you know, where we come from, I actually don't really like. My mother still lives there, and I go and visit her, but I don't like that area. Uh-huh. You know, I was very quick to let go of my connection to that place.
Yeah.
Because I've now made a new generation in a new place. Whether they stay there or not, we don't know that yet.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we'll find out. But for sure, my personal view of it would be, of course, space will be a different frontier. I don't think you'll be able to keep those ties very well. Mm-hmm. I don't think, mainly because I think the private sector will make it there much quicker than the public sector anyway.
Well, yeah, it'd be interesting for me to see a lot of these projects that have been discussed at this forum at the Liberty in Our Lifetime conference, to see how many of them are going to start thinking about outer space, particularly maybe, like you said, the seasteading projects, if they can then expand that model to... Because what I think is important is bringing these types of discussions into the more broader, you know, forum of outer space law and outer space politics, because, like I mentioned earlier, there's very little discussion about individual and freedom-oriented governance frameworks. And I would love to see free city proponents become part of that broader discussion.
I think in our case, the fact that it's so out there, mm-hmm. literally, means we would probably treat it on a kind of, it's interesting, but it's not important yet, because you can't actually build it yet. Like, there will be people almost certainly who will be interested in that. But you can build a seastead now. Mm-hmm. You can actually deal with the problems of the fact that you're living, whatever it is, outside of the 12.5 mile jurisdiction of it. Yeah. You've got that problem now. We've seen it actually transpire that without a flag, you get, like it happened in Thailand, the Thai army came out with guns and said, go away, mm-hmm. you know, because they didn't have a flag. If they'd have had a flag, they would have been fine. Uh-huh. Because then it would have been an international incident. Once people are, I suppose once normal people are traveling to space, not sort of trained, mm-hmm. you know, I think.
Yeah, right.
Because presumably, this is another question I was going to ask you. How does law work on space stations, for example, at the moment?
For instance, the International Space Station.
Something like that, yeah.
Well, that's divided up into several jurisdictions based on the countries that are partner to the ISS.
The actual station itself?
Yeah, so depending which module you're in, is depending which country's law is governing your conduct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's it. What? So the American could go into the Russian pod,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly there's things he can't do. He can smoke a spliff in the American one, but he can't go, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Does it work like that?
Well, what I would suspect, but what I suspect is that a lot of activity just happens anyway, whether it's sanctioned or not under the jurisdiction. That framework would be interesting and applied if something went wrong, if someone sabotaged something or there was a violent incident.
Yes.
That's when there would be you would revert back to the national law, is actually if, you know, someone is hurt or there's been damage onto something, how are we going to appropriate who's responsible for that, and how are we going to punish them? So, because I would imagine, again, I'm not sure, I haven't spoke to astronauts about this particularly, but I suspect that there's all kinds of things that happens on the International Space Station that aren't strictly legal. Things like, I'm not sure if they're experimenting.
Smoking. No, they're not smoking.
But I mean, just like here on Earth, right? We behave every day. We're breaking, I think there's some statistics out there from different organizations that say, you know, every day we break so many national laws.
Some more than others.
Yeah, yeah. But unknowingly, right?
Sure, yeah.
Especially if you're in a foreign country. But I mean, just even traffic laws or, you know, some of these social laws, these public nuisance laws, like yelling too loud. Is that a lot of police have discretion? So.
Yeah, and that's the point, especially in space. And like, I think what I'll always revert back to is the fact that Elon will beat NASA to Mars, I would imagine, because his company is more efficient and mm-hmm. it's incentivized to do better, mm-hmm. quicker than NASA. So when he gets there, and he's that kind of a guy as well, isn't he? I mean, I suppose recently you've seen him, you know, join forces with the government much more.
Yeah.
But he likes to stick the finger up to the government as well.
It's curious, and I don't know enough detail to speak to any authority on it, but it is the contracts he has through SpaceX launches my understanding is that it's essentially all government contracting is why this company can exist. It doesn't have enough revenue from non-government contracts yet to be sustainable. At least that's my understanding.
Sure.
So from various sources, that's my understanding. And so that then creates an interesting dynamic where the person, Elon Musk, and his social circles may have very critical points to say about the government, but in terms of SpaceX operating currently, there is some dependency on the state to be able to be sustainable. But that might be very much changing with the development that happened a couple of weeks ago, where the spacecraft was able to land back. I'm not sure if you saw that.
Yes.
And that so these kinds of developments will be bringing space launches further away from state dependency on the state for contracts and for missions. And so ultimately this is a good thing.
Well, unless, and you know, unfortunately historically this has always happened, when they realize they're being outcompeted and no longer needed, they'll just whack some legislations on there to sort of try and reel things in, which is what happens, unfortunately.
There's a I think it's called LSV. I'm not sure what the acronym is for, but it's a, I'm not sure if the government was motivated to compete with SpaceX, but it's United States Space Launch Vehicle. But it, because of it's a state project, and so there's distributed manufacturing and planning going on to build it, and so it's hugely expensive, and it's not at all competing with SpaceX because it's obviously a government centralized program. And you're using a lot of old technology because you're using the existing manufacturing bases you have in different, you know, politicians' constituency bases. There might be already a factory there that can produce this type of component, but that technology is several years old. So that means that that system on the launch vehicle has to be adaptive to that old technology. And that's where you see big differences between state-run missions and the private launch vehicles like SpaceX. And the Ariane rocket, which is Europeans' I guess Keystone launch vehicle, is facing a similar potential demise because it's just not going to be able to compete because of the production costs, and it's falling behind. So
it's all true.
Yeah, but again, so the next stage is that those private launch vehicles being the contracts that those private launch vehicles have, that their services that they're providing to customers, the next stage is that they'll be private customers. It'll be private, you know, missions and operations. It won't necessarily be a state, dependent on the state. That's the next stage that we're going into. For the bigger launches, there's lots and lots of small launch vehicles, which are called micro launches, which are only several feet high, that are designed specifically to compete with SpaceX, because they're cheaper to launch, they're cheaper to build, and you can have more flexibility in your launch cadence. You can launch quicker, more rapidly. And so these can only launch small payloads.
Satellites.
Yeah, small satellites, exactly. So, but my point is that we're already seeing a big movement away from those smaller launch vehicles being dependent on government and looking at private satellite companies, you know, companies that are developing satellite technologies. Those are providing a sustainable business model for those smaller launches.
What's the legal framework for satellites? Like, can you just fire a satellite anywhere that you want without asking too much? And what happens, like, who decides what sort of, you know, like, for example, you want to put a camera on a satellite.
Yeah,
that's obviously quite a contentious thing. Uh-huh. But people do it. I'm almost, you know, don't they? Google's got it, but a lot of other companies probably have, you know?
Yeah, and there's actually nothing in the I mean you can interpret particular provisions of the international space law framework to address issues like privacy, like putting a camera and doing Earth observation, but doing it for, you know, interesting purposes, let's say, like drones having this technology as well. There's no strict international legal provision that controls the privacy aspects of this type of situation. But in terms of launching a satellite, yes, there is legal frameworks that deal with that. Coming from, again, the international space law framework, you have to nominate a jurisdiction that's going to, you have to register the satellite with a particular state. And then that state's frameworks determine how you go about applying to get the regulatory approvals to do that. And then it also depends on where you're launching it or with which organization you're launching the satellite will have different implications as well. So there's a few different moving parts to consider when you're, if you're a satellite company or you're looking to invest in a satellite company, these types of considerations are quite important because traditionally when you're building a satellite, even because satellites are very cheap to build now, you can build satellites that do quite remarkable things for, you know, you can get off the shelf components and things like this. And school groups can build satellites now.
Really?
Yeah, it's particularly what's called a CubeSat, which you may have seen pictures of if you're looking in space magazines or there's a news
I've never
article
looked
about
in
space.
A space magazine in my life. I didn't even know they existed.
Yeah, there's a few newsletters going around. But usually if you see a news article or something talking about a new space phenomenon or private space activities, a typical image you'll see will be what it looks like. It's a cube. It's, I think, 9 centimeters by 9 centimeters. And this is a standardized way to build satellites now because you can put multiple cubes together to have 3 units or 6 units or 9 units, depending how big, you know, depending what your needs are for whatever you want to use the satellite for, will determine how many cubes you would need. And so that's one of the reasons why launch costs are becoming more affordable, is because you have a standardized way to build satellites. And it also means satellite manufacturing becomes more affordable as well because you have already the framework there to, you know, maneuver within. And this is why school groups and undergraduates can start building. So,
what, you're telling me that a cube that small can be a satellite? I mean, presumably you have to add a solar panel onto it and a few other things.
Yeah, mostly powered by solar.
But it can be like literally this big. You know, like,
yeah, like the analogy that people give is that typically it's a three-unit CubeSat, and the bread loaf is what people, a large bread loaf is what this looks like. And so this is how a lot of, like this is, I'm not sure exactly if Starlink uses CubeSats or not, but it's a, but they use, the concept I'm trying to draw to is Starlink's operating by using swarms or constellations of satellites. So it's not one big satellite that traditionally with telecommunications would sit in geostationary Earth orbit and you know, 36,000 kilometers away. These types of satellites are working more in what's called low Earth orbit, and that's much closer to Earth. And because they're smaller satellites, you create a constellation of them to be able to, in effect, produce the outcome that you want, whether it's Earth observation or whether you're setting up a communications network. So you don't just rely on one. But for experimental purposes, you usually do just have one or three of them put together. And then that's when it becomes cheaper because you're only launching one. You only need to reserve one spot in your launch vehicle contract instead of having to have several launches. That's why for experimentation purposes, it's common for school groups or universities or, you know, new research institutions to test satellite technologies using this CubeSat standard.
I didn't know that. Mm. So these CubeSats, what's the final size of one satellite if you include all the bits you add on? If there's, like, say there's three cubes, you know, like power source, you know, because they have to be quite big.
So the power source is then, well, no, not really. I mean, they have, I'm not sure what the number is, but a lot of the constellations are either 3 units or 6 units. So it's just the nine, I think it's 9 by 9 centimeters. I'm not sure what that is in inches. And you're just blocking them together with how much, you know, whatever power you need or whatever components you need in there. But quite a lot of them are just 3 units. So it's 9, 9, 9 long and then 9 wide. And then this is the actual end spacecraft that you'll see orbiting Earth.
Really?
Yeah, and like you say, sometimes if they're powered by solar, they'll have wings that can extend so that they can take the power coming
and
from
when
the
sun. I'm going to ask a few stupid questions here. When you load a bunch of those up into a payload rocket, how do they release them once they get into orbit? Do they just open a bay door and they all fall out?
Yeah, exactly right. So really? Once the rocket reaches its certain trajectory or its certain altitude, what's called the payload fairing, which is usually the top part of a rocket. Again, I'm not sure on the percentages. When you look at a picture of a rocket like a Falcon 9 or the Ariane Space or in the old rockets that NASA was launching, a majority of all that rocket is just the boosting capability to get it up into space. The payload is sitting, the satellites are sitting usually right at the very top, a minority of the launch vehicle. And that fairing eventually, when it detaches from the rest of the fuel sources or the boosters, the lower part of the rocket, will open up or will break up and then the satellites will just come out naturally.
And there must be a requirement for them to not to be spaced apart a bit, a little bit, or something.
Isn't yeah, it? This is not my area, but this is a big. A lot of people are focusing on this. Is the orbital slots that you. You know, how do we manage this? Because there's
well, if you've got people from schools doing school projects and sending stuff up there,
yeah, and this is
it's
why
it's getting a bit out of control.
Yeah, it does, and this is why registration is important. That you because once you register with your country, that country's government then has to put it on an international registry, which is monitored or at least hosted by the United Nations, and so that they maintain a registry of all the spacecraft in orbit or all the spacecraft that have been launched. And so that determines, you know, what kind of orbital slots you can have and where you're going. And so that puts in some coordination here, which is one reason why registration is important, because if you're just launching something into who knows where, you've got to get there. So you've got to make sure that when you're getting there, you're not going to be sabotaging anybody else's mission, or you're not going to be causing any collisions. And this is why it's important. It's not so much, this is why the international community is focused on it rather than particular companies or organizations, is because if your satellite collides with another spacecraft, that's not good. You've lost your investment, or you have to do the whole thing again. But on a much greater impact of that is that you have a somewhat of a domino effect where the breakup of that collision, will cause further damage, and it becomes almost exponential. It's called the Kessler effect. And that could lead to, whole orbital slots being inaccessible because it's just filled with debris and broken components.
Has that ever happened before?
There's been a lot of near misses, quite a few. Any of the collisions that have happened, have I'm not aware of any, but if they have happened in areas of space that, either don't matter or are manageable. But this is something that the community is very worried about, because if it does happen, then it gets out of line very, very quickly. And then not only do the orbital slots become inaccessible for new satellites, you may be damaging some satellite infrastructure that are providing vital services on Earth, helping out with, satellite connectivity, and then that has flow-on effects in instances like agriculture, which is relying on those technologies for their automated machinery or for their Earth observation. A lot of manufacturing and logistics is dependent on satellite connectivity. So when you start thinking about all these satellites providing those services being damaged, then those services have bottlenecks in them now, and that causes a lot of disruption to food security, healthcare, education, just day-to-day living.
Blimey, it's fascinating. Yeah. I take it that your work at Live and Let Live Foundation has nothing to do with space.
It actually doesn't, except for the fact that once we get enough momentum, I'd like to, get some of the discussions that are happening in the forums facilitated by Live and Let Live to start thinking about these types of questions and trying to, like I said, with the Free Cities community, it would be great if some of their input could be coming into the international space law community because of their insights and what they're doing. And I think Live and Let Live could be one avenue for that, for my own personal.
Well, it almost certainly can be that, because,
Like you said, there may not be an incentive for the Free City pioneers to be thinking about space just yet, but certainly their experiences and their perspectives will have a lot of value in the space law discussions.
And I'll repeat what I said. I think the most space adjacent part of our community is the seasteading community, mm-hmm. because it involves craft out in non-jurisdictions, mm-hmm. very, very similar. I think I do see it as the stepping stone. I think that's probably the place where the most can be learnt. And even from a legal perspective, because maritime law is a different type of law than your average law.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And a lot of people don't even realize that, I think, mm-hmm. But you maritime law and space law will probably have a lot in common.
Yes. Yeah. Well, in terms of maritime law, one difference is that it's quite well established. It's been here for centuries and been developing, and it's quite well practiced now. But space law, though, there's a growing number of space law experts, at least in the international community, still a lot of these ideas aren't tested yet. So we don't know how the law will apply. And again, like you mentioned before, and the enforceability of particular laws causes challenges as well. And so, there's some lessons from maritime law good baselines, but just because of the nature of space missions and the environment there, not all of it can be directly transferable.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Have you got a vision of the future at all, according to you, you know, from a legal perspective up there? Or, you know, what do you think will actually transpire?
For me, it's very hard to think about time frames, about when this will start happening. Because I couldn't tell you how if I think it'll be happening in my lifetime or not. But I think that one concern I have is that if the international legal frameworks that we have aren't challenged with innovative governance ideas, my concern is that we'll be stuck in those legal frameworks when we are ready to start doing more longer term space flight missions or even being on space habitats or things like this. And so my interest is to try and broaden the discussion to think of new governance models, you know, particularly ones that are focused on individual rights and property rights, and make sure that, you know, we're not just stuck in this framework that we have right now, which so far, to be fair, has fared quite well with the types of the space activities we're doing. And there's enough people talking about, you know, how we can develop these laws and get them more flexible, but that's not extending to, you know, more property rights or individual rights. And that's what concerns me, is that when the Free City pioneers start doing projects in outer space, it might then already be too late to try and put in new governance models, because it might already be surrounded by what we have now.
I think, like all frontiers, space will have its time of chaos where anything goes. Mm-hmm. And then same with the internet, there's cyber space was a free space. Mm-hmm. When it first started. Now there are legislations trying to eat their way in, and you can't do this and you can't look at that and you can't, that's probably the trajectory it would follow, I would imagine. But once again, unfortunately, you've got Titus's book down there,
yeah,
Three Private Cities.
To get into this. Yeah.
It's a very applicable, that particular model, the free private city, where the city operator is someone you sign a contract with, and there are the rules in perpetuity, mm-hmm. and you are the customer essentially of the city operator. Mm-hmm. That model seems to be the perfect model for space, because it doesn't have to be a nation thing, does it? You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like it's really a product that you're offering.
Yeah.
In the same way, like I say, it's somewhere between. Well, the nearest thing we've got to it, you heard about Prospera in... And obviously they're struggling now because of the local state, sort of trying to make them illegitimate, but it's a political reason that they're doing it, not a reason of prosperity or that the project isn't working or that it's doing harm or anything. It's a purely political reason. Uh-huh. And I think in space, it would be lovely to get away from that and just have a bunch of competing products. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to go live on Mars? Well, there's four jurisdictions and they each have there's this one and this one. And here are the benefits. Here's the contract.
Yep.
You want to join? As long as you follow the rules, you're all good.
It's such a shame that we have to think about it in the terms of going to space to have that opportunity, right? Like this, like you mentioned, the seasteading people and organizations might are the best way to test that now, because it's disconcerting to the fact that we can't do this here on Earth already.
Well, we did. I mean, you know, the US, when people left Europe to go to the US, it was a frontier. Obviously, it was an occupied frontier, so you've got all that kind of... But that's the historical way frontiers worked. Mm. They were places that weren't claimed en masse. Mm. And we're living through a stage in history. States have never... Well, no, that's not strictly true, actually. States have been large before, obviously. But they haven't had the technologies that exist now to kind of enforce their rules. Mm-hmm. The most interesting, I think, and also dystopian kind of future occurs with the help of the internet, unfortunately. And you see it in a number of countries around the world already emerging, which is having the law... So the law is part of an incentive system that you have on your phone, for example.
Right.
So you have a social credit score like they have in some... I think China is pretty much at the forefront of this. And it's basically a score of your obedience to the rules. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not obedient, then you can't buy a train ticket with your money because it's all tied together. And this is very disturbing for me. And I think once you get into space, it would be nice to think that that might be a new frontier, that at least for the first 100 years, people could live a little bit freer, maybe, like they did in every other frontier in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. But technology is obviously, you know, I don't want to sound too negative, but the fact that that technology exists for the authoritarian urge means it also exists for the urge for freedom. Uh-huh. And as a result, we see in the, you know, in the financial sector, we see Bitcoin as a decentralized currency that can't be stopped, as opposed to a central bank digital currency. Mm-hmm. We see, you know, it's decentralized versions of all the centralized things that are happening are springing up from the bottom up.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's very so positive. And just in the last couple of days, being in this energy with all those people who are so supportive of that, you know, philosophy of coming from the ground up and making sure that, you know, you have the choice of how you live your life. I mean, this is why the Live and Let Live movement resonates with me, is because its name is the Live and Let Live.
What, out of interest then, and this is a question that, and don't take this the wrong way, but it's a kind of tongue-in-cheek question.
Great.
What radicalized you?
Yeah, I used to think about it in radicalization as well until I realized that actually it's just what we're doing now is radical. How you said before about the homesteading and the pioneers in the United States, which was actually the more natural way that humans are interacting with each other. And so, I was leaning towards trying to understand more how my home country is Australia. And a few years ago, I was getting more interested in, you know, because I started working a lot more and was being affected by different laws and policies and things like this. And I was trying to understand the rationale, because my training is in my early stage of my career was in criminal law. And so I was analyzing, you know, the legal provisions of the criminal code that were affecting my clients and trying to work out why this provision exists, because obviously the intention was completely different for the situation that my client's in. It's applying because they just didn't consider the unintended consequence of how far-reaching this law would be. And then when I started thinking about that in non-criminal law perspectives, it occurred to me that, you know, basically every law that I was looking at didn't have a clear justification as to why it exists and didn't have any clear monitoring mechanism to make sure that, you know, is the law being effective? How often are we revisiting this law? And so that grew some skepticism in me. And then I guess my dad as well is involved in politics. And so somewhat being involved in the lion's den and seeing how all that operates, lost a lot of
faith.
When I was young, I used to presume that, you know, these people who have power to control our lives may not be greater people or ubermenschen, but they might have more insights or more capabilities than the average person. And the more I learned about politics and met politicians, and particularly bureaucrats, the more I understood that, no, these people, in fact, it's usually the opposite.
I was going to say, hopefully you realized it's the complete opposite.
Yes.
Uh-huh. They don't add value. They're not entrepreneurs. They don't create value.
That's right.
It's the opposite. They survive on other people's, the fruits of other people's work. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just discussions with fortunately my father isn't one of those. And so having discussions, candid ones with him about this as well, somewhat just validated my observations. And then I guess the final nail in the coffin was during the coronavirus lockdowns. That's really when I understood that, okay, I'm not crazy. This is, this the world is crazy.
Another COVID refugee. I mean, without sounding too, what's the word? Basically, COVID has created more members of this community than any other act in the West, at least, in history, recent history, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, almost a backfire, isn't it?
but that's how this is how it works. Mm-hmm. It's the same with if you ever get despondent about freedom, if you if you look at the thing you're despondent about, you will eventually see an equal and opposite force. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of this. Mm-hmm. All you are is you're the, you know, everyone becomes an enemy of the state in the end, if mm-hmm. it gets big enough. Like you say, we're all breaking mm-hmm. laws accidentally every day. And in the end, there's so many laws and it's so overpowering that everyone's a criminal. And at that point, what are you going to do? Uh-huh. You're not a criminal. You're a normal human being. You're actually a very moral person, almost certainly. Mm-hmm. You think deeply about things. You know, this mm-hmm. is when mm-hmm. you, this is what radicalizes people. And, you know, let's, I'm using that candidly, that phrase.
I got it. Yeah. So, obviously during that, just was exposed much more to, you know, forum like podcasts and things like this. And then obviously reading a lot of the work that a lot of guests on the podcast would be talking about, and somewhat of a rabbit hole, which again didn't really change my views. It just justified them more or less. And then finding community, like that's how I became in contact with Mark Victor, one of the founders of the Live and Let Live movement, was through his appearance on a podcast. And so I just reached out and continued discussions that way. And then similar with the Free Cities movement as well. It's not a coordinated effort. There's all these little pockets of freedom oriented movements. But I think, you know, things like this conference have shown that when there's more connection, there's a sense of synergy, and it's going in the right direction. Even if we're not working, you know, together on projects, we still have the right movement. And I think that makes a difference. It will make a difference, at least.
I think it makes a phenomenal difference.
I may be overly optimistic, but and it was hard to be pessimistic over the last couple of days.
Yeah, I disagree with the fact that you can be overly optimistic. Uh-huh. this group of people is what it is. You know, it's a response to a situation that everyone individually finds themselves in. Mm. And it's a bottom-up, as you can see, it's a bottom-up movement, mm-hmm. Which is very difficult to stop because it's based on, as you discovered, a large amount of ideas that actually live on regardless of what anyone does mm-hmm. or says. And fortunately for us, we live in the internet age, which is a revolution on the scale of the printing press, as far as I'm concerned, with information. And lo and behold, you live in Australia, you hear two people from a completely different country speaking about something on the other side of the world, across time.
Yep.
I mean, this is the world we live in now. I mean, it's phenomenal. People could listen to this conversation in 4 weeks' time in Uganda mm-hmm. and wake up one morning and invent something that changes the world. You know, like, we live in a phenomenal time. There's absolutely no reason to not be optimistic.
Yeah, fair enough. And it's almost it feels like a sense of cheating, or, you know, taking the quick way around, because when you listen to conversations like this, a lot of the hard work has already been done in terms of the, you know, people have been writing books about particular issues and subjects and have done they've put in all the labor, and you get to benefit from it from reading their work. And I'm just imagining this, you know, 200 years ago, when you didn't have those channels, you had to do all the hard work yourself to come to these ideas and to work, to question what was happening around you. And now it's much easier.
Well, kind of. I mean, we all, you know, the old expression, we all sit on the shoulders of giants or whatever. Mm-hmm. We do. I mean, that's the only thing you're discussing. You know, I've been talking to people on this podcast for 2 years now, over 100 episodes, hours and hours and hours of discussion. And all that's happening is my understanding of all these things is getting better and better and better. Mm-hmm. I'm challenging more and more of my own preconceptions, my own ideas, and then talking, like, I didn't realize space, you had little cubes you could send into space from school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like, this is what it's all about. This is the age we live in, the age of making these connections. And mm-hmm. you never win this battle. You just win a few little battles, but the whole thing is just the ebb and the flow.
Yeah.
There's people that want to tell you what to do and people that want to let you leave you free to come, you know, to create. Uh-huh. And I think it's an age old battle. It'll happen in space. It'll happen at sea. Mm. Happens in Australia when they lock you down. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a question of choosing, or not even choosing. It's a question of discovering which side you're on, and just ignore the other stuff. Just do your thing. Create your creation.
Yeah, there's something to be said about, you know, winning those little battles, even if, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done. Something I've become more passionate about in the recent years is teaching, particularly law and economics, and it's very promising when you talk about politics and economics, putting them, you know, contrasting each other and presenting them that way to students, particularly to undergraduates. It's very promising to see them interact and understand these ideas, which, you know, from the textbooks that are in most universities, don't talk about it in those contexts. They talk about economic policy as it's run by governments rather than by markets. And so for me, those are little wins. When you see students who are engaging in the discussion and actually you can see it resonating with them, there is an appetite for trying to understand these concepts in the reality that we are.
Especially in economics. I studied economics at school. Uh-huh. It was boring as hell.
Uh-huh, yeah.
If someone had taught me the economic principles from the human experience,
yeah,
I'd have been all over it,
uh-huh,
as I am now. You know, I discovered economics later in life. I always thought it boring. It literally turned me off at age 17, 18.
Yeah, all those graphs and numbers. And
No mention of human action, no mention of decisions and incentives and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And because it really, economics is one of the most fascinating subjects to study.
It's the human
experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And
how we make decisions, what the effects of those decisions
exactly
are. It's wonderful.
But it's never framed like that at school. You get the odd person lucky enough to be exposed to, say, Austrian economics at university or whatever. But on the whole, not in the slightest. Do you teach at an academic institution?
Yeah, a few different ones in different capacities. So I do more short programs or courses within, you know, a larger curriculum. And that gives me an exposure to different institutions and looking at how the students from those institutions, like one of them is with an MBA course on space entrepreneurship. Another one is on teaching space law and economics and policy to non-legal and economic professionals, so to scientists and engineers. And it's very interesting to get to have the different interactions with different people from different backgrounds and experiences.
Wow, you teach space entrepreneurship. Dude, welcome to the 21st century. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
I love that.
That one's in Adelaide, which is a very space-oriented city in Australia. Actually, it's where the Australian Space Agency is headquartered for that reason, because there's so much activity happening there. And so there's a lot of small businesses that are doing quite wonderful things in that city. But you can find them everywhere, in Europe and in Asian countries. Because it's so much easier to find capital to do these space missions now, because it's so easy, it's so much cheaper to be able to develop them. So you've got lots of pockets of, you know.
What are the big new movements in the space entrepreneurship then? I suppose small satellites is obviously one of them. Rockets that go up and come back down, that's obviously a big one now, right?
Yeah, well, those types of developments are expensive and do require, it took, you know, SpaceX how many years to get that technology working. So that's much broader, bigger, high investment projects. It's more about space applications, about how we're using satellites on Earth. So a lot of the space entrepreneurs may be developing satellites for specific purposes, but a lot of it is about what's called downstream space, and that's about what we're using space capabilities for, whether it's for connectivity and telecommunications, or, you know, looking at the Earth from space, which helps with agriculture and environmental management. But also with, you know, criminal law and, you know, human migration and things like this.
Criminal law as in spotting, you know, using...
You can go back and work out whose car was there or, you know...
From historical
pictures. Yeah, because you can get pretty remarkable resolution now, particularly for services if you subscribe for a fee for them. You can get pretty good resolution, you know, down below 10
centimeters. So there's private companies creating a record of everything that happens on the planet using satellite imagery.
It'll be stored in a server somewhere. Yeah,
God.
I'm not sure how much of it is recorded, because a lot of it might just, you know, they might get rid of it if it's not for a particular customer or something like this. I'm not exactly sure how that market works, but it's a lot of data. If they were recording that amount and keeping it, that would be a lot of data.
Tell me another project then, another sort of downstream space project that I probably haven't heard of.
Well, a lot of them are connecting IoT systems with satellite
That's Internet of Things.
Exactly.
Yeah. People get so used to saying IoT, but hardly anyone knows what it means.
Yeah, and because it's so integrated now into a lot of, you know, these advanced tech systems that it's often just not even spoken of because it's an assumed part of new systems. But in Australia, at least, it's very popular for agricultural operations because of the vast, you know, the remoteness of different infrastructure you'll have on a farm or a cattle station. Having devices that you have reliable connectivity and quick connectivity to from your phone or your tablet or a bespoke bit of machine is very useful, and satellite technology gives you that reliability. So that's a good use case as well.
Wow. That's all a lot to take in, Scott.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, I'm glad you found the whole experience here inspiring as well, because I think this is the mission we're all on, is spreading, planting seeds in different places. And you know, if you can take the ideas of liberty and prosperity and individual freedoms.
Yeah, well, there is a connection that I'm trying to harness now with some projects, is that because with space applications, so using space typically for connectivity or for Earth observation, or another one is for, you know, navigation and timing systems. These three core ways that we use space on Earth, because of how much cheaper it is to access these now, it's getting more feasible for individuals or small communities who may be in areas with low living standards to benefit from these capabilities without having any dependency on foreign aid organizations or state, you know, programs or something like this. And so one of my interests is trying to promote areas, and there are many organizations that do this from different angles, is to just empower local communities to say, hey, if you're having this challenge with your, you know, sanitation with your water or something, why don't we try and, you know, rely on satellite connectivity to help you monitor that water or help you get it to where it needs to go in a cleaner way. And usually this is more affordable than you would think. It's a very low overhead to set something like that up. And it doesn't require, you know, big 5-year-long projects from an aid organization or something like this. So there is a sense of individual empowerment that is accessed.
Do you mean using someone else's satellite, obviously?
Yeah, so you wouldn't be involved in the development of the satellite, you can use, someone else has spent all that investment developing it and you just access it. I mean, the Copernicus system is the European Union's satellite system for Earth observation. And that is, I mean, not only is the information free from that, they also have tools that are free as well. So you can actually use software or platforms that for free to interpret the imagery in a way that is useful for whatever you're using it for, whether it's for measuring the water content of your farm or trying to get patterns of rainfall or,
really? You know, it's free.
Or erosion or something like that. Yeah, it's free.
What
is
it, a public service?
Well, when I say it's free, it's a public service. So, but the point is that there are now commercial entities doing similar, more bespoke or more specific missions to provide Earth imagery data, which aren't free but are very affordable in terms of subscriptions. And if you had
So what other applications might they have other than monitoring my agricultural setup or whatever?
It depends on the particular application you're using.
Give me some examples. I'm struggling to think of them myself.
Well, I mean, so financial services are heavily dependent on satellite connectivity from more of the timing aspects, because satellites provide very precise, you know, atomic timing capabilities and reliability for financial transactions. So whenever you're doing taking money from an ATM or doing a transaction through a bank on the internet or purchasing something, most likely it's going to, that timestamp that is being put on your transaction is facilitated through satellite technology. And going back to the Kessler effect that I mentioned earlier about if you have a collision with outer spacecraft with satellites that collide, and then that causes a domino effect with more collisions and more components, you can wipe out, you know, quite large financial systems because of the dependence that financial institutions have on the timing that's provided through satellite technology. So it's not always new things that we're looking at putting on. It's how do we make the existing infrastructure more reliable or resilient, rather, to protect us if, you know, we have those issues.
So you reckon in the future, we'll, in a free city, we'll be able to create our own financial network up in space, even launch them ourselves? Have an independent one.
That would be great, wouldn't it? If you could not have to rely on Earth-based infrastructure.
Well, I mean, I think like, you know, if you take Bitcoin as an example, it's a decentralized network of transactions.
Yeah.
It just needs the internet to run, but it would be nice to have your own satellite up there, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Elon can switch his satellite off, and he can, you know, if you believe in uncensorability, I suppose the ultimate would be to have your own series of satellites up there. How much does it cost to put a little satellite up there?
You know, I'm not exactly sure on the, and it depends on which provider you're going with, but it's not much. If you have one unit, you know, this, again, it's actually larger than 9 centimeters. I'm not sure exactly the size of a one unit CubeSat. But it's, you know, several thousands of dollars. It's not hundreds of thousands.
Is it really?
Yeah, the difficulty is finding a slot because there's so much demand for...
What, to buy the unit and get it into space is several thousand?
Okay, no, I'm talking only about the launch contracts, the launch fees to get it into space.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, compared
it's like
to...
It's like a business class flight across the Earth or something.
Yeah. I mean, and these contracts could be long-term contracts, because over time you may need to launch several of these to perform your mission.
How much does the box cost then?
Well, it depends. I mean, I don't know. I want to say nothing, because it just depends on what material you're making it from. And I'm not sure what materials are best, but the box is not so much the cost of developing the satellite. It's more about the labor to produce the system that you want the satellite to be hosting. So you may need to do novel engineering projects to get, you know, something. You may have something that's traditionally very large and you want to compact it all into a satellite to be able to send it into space, and so that takes time and effort to get a lot of heads involved in the room and work out how to make that feasible.
God,
but so if you want to just do something very simple, like have it, you know, connect to something, you know, have a telemetry system, you know, so you can just measure, feed information just for an experiment, this would cost basically nothing to do. You'd be paying, the costs would be in the launch costs, not in the development costs.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that really does show the cost of technology screaming downwards. Imagine the notion a few years ago that you could send, that a school research project could send something up into space and then take data from it. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. You can see the trend from these state-commanded missions, you know, from the 70s and 80s, and then it started to migrate into the private entities, realizing that, you know, we can also access space and benefit from that. But in those times, in the 80s and 90s, it was mostly dependent on government contracting. And government subsidies, or being involved in a government project or something like that. And then when this CubeSat wasn't the only thing that pushed the trend outwards, but it was a big facilitator for, once you have a standardized way to build a satellite, then it becomes much cheaper. And then, yeah, you can have, everybody can get involved. And then technology, of course, develops much quicker because you have more hands and heads thinking about problems and trying to take things to the next level.
Wow.
The issue is the appetite of risk. There's still a lot of risk in how you actually launch this into space and do it in a safe way and do it in a way that you know is going to be reliable. And so I think in the next few years, when I say few years, I'd say within 10 years, the market for these smaller launches, these launch vehicles, I should say, will have flattened out a little bit, and you'll have a few of those small launches that have been successful with their business models and their technology. And I think that's when you'll start to see a much higher increase of, you know, community engagement and small businesses trying to solve their problems through satellites is when it becomes much more reliable and cheaper.
And what's your prediction then on the part where the private sector gets more excited about further afield?
Doing in-space activities?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure, because right now there's a lot of work going into space resources, so, you know, extracting minerals from asteroids or other space, you know, celestial objects. But for purposes on Earth, and I'm not sure, but I suspect even the technology development to do that extraction and the, you know, the resource exploration, it's still not financially feasible yet from a, you know, in terms of making any returns. But again, the mining, you know, institution, the mining organizations take a long time to earn back their return as well. But I think the business case for in space mining or in space, you know, taking minerals is not yet there. But I think that'll be the first ledge to go over for the private activities in space to actually make it. So it won't be more about, it won't be about habitat so much, or about living or doing things in space. It'll be more about the taking resources from space.
But obviously, you'll need to live out there if you're taking the resources.
That'll be a stepping stone. Well, yeah, it depends how the extent of your automation and your robotic systems.
Yeah. Humans aren't going to be doing anything in the future, are we? I forgot.
It's much cheaper. Yeah, exactly. Also, right now, it's cheaper, like it is on Earth, I guess, for a lot of tasks to use.
Like drone technology in wars.
Yeah.
You don't have to go out and fight if you can just sit there with a joystick and move the drone around.
Yeah, wow.
God, my brain doesn't think like that. I don't, you know.
To be honest, it's hard for me as well. This is the field I'm in, and it's hard to think about where. That's why I have so much respect for visionaries in this sector, because they can think those four or five steps ahead.
Yes, but it's useful to have a goal which is in sight. Mm-hmm. Like I say, I think the living in outer space goal, for me personally anyway, and I would imagine for quite a few people in this movement, is a little bit too far away to give too much credence to. However, like I say, because living in space is so similar to living at sea in many aspects, and that is a reality right now, and actually, especially within that movement of people living at sea, there's so many working examples of it and so many prototypes being made of new ways of doing it. That's the place where all the exciting stuff, which is probably happening now, and I'm sure there'll be 1,001 lessons to learn from what happens there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm interested to keep an eye on all these things. I mean, something that interests me is the behavioral aspects. I mean, these seasteading projects, what I understood from them was their intention is to have larger communities, have interactions between the people at seasteads. But while that's before those communities are large enough, my interest is about the psychological effects of being in that type of environment, especially if you're in a smaller community where you have this sense of isolation. And there's a lot of analogies with space missions, because a big area in space now is doing analog missions and putting humans in remote places, in somewhere far away in Scandinavia or in the Arctic or Antarctic, or in a desert elsewhere somewhere on a continent, and just putting them in there, particularly to do research on space missions. And there's so many interesting social phenomena, and this is excluding the physical environment of outer space, where you have radiation and very low gravity and spatial disorientation. So even excluding all those environmental factors, there's still so many differences that how humans are interacting with each other and their tolerance levels, how they solve problems.
Sure. And I mean, once again, seasteading is a good place to look for those people.
I think so.
But they are a certain breed. I mean, for example, Grant, did you hear Grant Ramont's talk? He's the guy that's actually living in a seastead.
Uh-huh, yes.
And his business partner's been underwater now for 37 days.
Yeah, great.
He's going to do 120 days, because that's fantastic. The record.
Yeah. Well, I can almost guarantee there'll be at least a few space law articles written about that.
But I'll tell him that, because that's a 6-meter room. And apparently, it's not very big. Uh-huh. Obviously you can see out the porthole. It's very similar to being in space.
Yeah, right.
But Grant was laughing. He said probably the guy that's down there, I forget his name, is his business partner. Mm-hmm. He said he'll probably pop up at 120 days to sort of celebrate and but he'll go back down.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Because he likes it down there.
Wow.
So it's a mindset thing. Yep. That would drive me insane. When he described it to me, that's basically prison for me. Mm-hmm. I could not live in a 6-meter diameter room for 120 days without going completely insane.
I think this would be very difficult for me to do as well, but more challenging would be the fact in that situation where he's in, it sounds like if he needs to go back up, he could if something went wrong. In outer space, you don't have that option.
Right.
You're on your own for sure.
The fear.
Yeah.
For me, it would be fear.
Yeah, yeah.
That's literally a panic attack area, isn't it? Uh-huh.
I mean, if you have everything you need there, then it's not a problem. But I mean, in those early stages where, like a lot of what astronauts were doing in the early times, it's pretty bold.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. I mean, they are pioneers. And I think that in seasteading, you see the same pioneers. They're not necessarily normal people like you and I. Mm-hmm. When seasteads are floating cities at sea or in estuaries or whatever, and they've got trees on them, and they've got, that's when normal people will be there. Uh-huh. At the moment, it's seafaring folk, it's people that like living in boats, it's, these kind of people.
Yeah.
And But it'll come, like all of these things. You know, we may not live to see the Mars plans, mm-hmm. but there'll be cities on Mars. You can sort of see it now, can't you? Unless we have some catastrophic human, you know, like a something that sets us back historically, right. you know, like technologically, which a lot of people would predict.
Yeah. Does that mean all the knowledge goes as well? Or just have to start again with the...
I don't know. I think the globalness of everything right. these days means that if there's a large war between two large states, mm-hmm. that's pretty destructive because most of the capital is concentrated in certain places, isn't mm-hmm. it? And it would obviously right. set us back. I don't know how long. I don't even know how you predict how long it
yeah.
was.
Yeah.
But something along those lines would be pretty devastating.
I've never thought about it in those terms because there would also be, of course, many opportunities that would come from something like that, no matter what the destruction was. And I wonder how you can try and predict or at least appreciate what new avenues might come from that type of setback, because it wouldn't be all doom and gloom. Maybe a majority of it would be, especially if there was destruction, but
and also radiation.
This type of thing. Yeah. Well, then yes.
Well, I mean, that's the only that's the main existential threat we have, isn't it? Really, to the human species. I'm not someone that thinks climate change is going to wipe us out,
right?
But a nuclear war could.
This is fascinating to me that it's not more spoken about. Particularly with all the current situations happening from a geopolitical level, because I can't say I'm worried about it, but I can certainly appreciate the worries that people have about it. And I just think I'm not worried about it because I'm not aware enough of how close we might be to it or how potential.
Well, take that thought into the future, in the technological future, you know, drones, military drones, mm-hmm. you know, now... You know, we went to an event the other day and there was a drone show in the sky. It must have been 600 or 700 of these things creating beautiful patterns in the sky. Mm. And you think, Jesus, this is...
Who's behind that? Could have a lot of power.
Of course they could. They can already do that, obviously.
Yeah.
And that's now. Mm. What about 50 years in the future? What about 150 years? What about 1,000 years into the future? Mm-hmm. We enter this place where people like you and I have access to phenomenally powerful technology in a destructive sense as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that one in whatever number of people is a complete psychopath.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
it just takes one, yeah?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know. I'm obviously missing a lot of the incentives that will be active in the future, but
it's probably a healthy way to look at it though, if you can be cautiously approaching it or
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I just know. I mean, I kind of trust the human species. You know, I trust the market of human ideas.
Uh-huh.
And I think when you look around, you see the majority of people are good. Unfortunately, when you look around, you see the majority of people don't necessarily believe in individual liberty.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a common idea mm-hmm. when it actually comes down to it.
Mm-hmm.
When you saw that during COVID.
Oh, yeah.
It was pretty disappointing, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was fascinating. Uh-huh.
Well, I'd say disappointing. I think fascinating too as well, but really disappointed in what transpired then.
Mm-hmm.
But historically, we've known that as well. I mean, there's plenty of historical examples of people reacting in exactly the same way.
Yeah.
So I can only suggest that that's probably the case going forward as well, you know.
Yeah, unless we can have... the path that all these delegates are on at this conference and all the other, you know, freedom-oriented, friendly organization. I mean, that's one thing Live and Let Live is trying to do, is fill this gap in communicating the message to stakeholders or audiences who, you know, may have been very happy to be under the COVID lockdowns and things like this, is to try and communicate this non-aggression principle or voluntarianism in a very specific way to specific audiences, or depending on the audience, to try and fill the gap with what, you know, organizations like the Libertarian Party or other freedom and rights oriented movements might not be doing. They may have a particular stakeholder group that they can connect with, but that message doesn't resonate with people who, you know, aren't willing to think about the new ideas or think about ways. And that's one reason why I'm interested in the Live and Let Live movement, is because it's really trying to tailor the way that the message is communicated, not changing the message. So we call it the Live and Let Live. We say there's two principles under the Live and Let Live movement that would make the world almost a perfect place to live. One of them is the legal principle, which essentially is the non-aggression principle, but moving away from that branding, let's say, and communicating that in a way to say, you know, live and let live. Don't don't hurt anybody, don't take their stuff, these kinds of things. And then the other principle is the moral principle, live and let live moral principle, which is to say that we don't suggest that this is obligatory, but what we encourage you to do is try and find interactions or be the best version of yourself, be an excellent human being, we say. Because once you have freedom and individual rights protected and your property rights are protected, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're living in a happy place or a great or a, you know, in that you're the best version of yourself or you're in the best community that's inspiring you to do better. So beyond the obligatory legal principle, which is the non-aggression principle, we encourage individuals and organizations to also try and, you know, present values that might be, you know, related to stoicism or what it means to be a virtuous human being. Try and help people, try and be, you know, to a certain degree tolerant with people who have different views from you, be able to disagree reasonably rather than outrageously. And all these types of things helps us elevate our sense of community or ourselves beyond just having freedom and rights protected. And I think that's an interesting spin that the Live and Let Live movement is putting on this outlook, is to try and say that, yes, because that's a big criticism that, you know, libertarian organizations have is that, yeah, great, but this just means everything is commercial. This just means that we're transaction with each other, because there's a lot of emphasis on, you know, property rights and, you know, not being taxed, which principles I agree with. But if you just say that to someone who's been paying tax their whole life and their parents have been paying tax and, you know, they get a free tram ride to work every day or something, that doesn't resonate with those people. And so you need to figure out other ways to have a conversation with them. And that's what this Live and Let Live movement is trying to facilitate our stakeholders and beneficiaries to do, is give them tools and resources on how you could be engaging.
Well, good luck with it.
It's an ambitious goal, but they're the ones that are worth...
People are either open to these ideas or not.
Yeah, you think?
Take anarchism's a good example, you know, like most people think anarchy seems like some terrible idea of complete mayhem and this, that, and the other. But you and I are engaged in anarchy right now.
That's right.
Literally. Yep. Yep. But when you phrase it like that, it actually makes people, like you said, you didn't learn these things. You found other people telling you these things and you agreed with them.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, okay.
Do you know what I mean? And uh-huh. I think that's basically how these things work. I think there's a lot of people out there that believe in this stuff. It's just never been articulated to them. And I was probably one of those myself.
Right.
Historically, I probably was.
Yeah, I think, and there are some organizations, I think, that do promote anarchy and libertarianism and rights that do try and, you know, teach you communication methods to, you know, have a discussion with someone and to manage your own emotions and passion so you can still stay in the moment with that other person and react with them. And I think there's something to be said about that, because if you can find the thing or the aspect in someone's life that they're valuing a lot, you can, if you really know your libertarian principles or your, you know, the voluntarianism concept, you'll be able to connect it back to those principles somehow. And that's the way to communicate to those people. Even if you can't, you know, bring them on side right away, at least if you can make your point to them, I think that's better than them going off without even understanding what you've understood. And it's a shame that, I agree with what you were saying about anarchy, is that there's a connotation with this to mean like, you know, chaos, and which obviously chaos doesn't have a negative connotation necessarily as well, but it's associated with, you know, destruction and, you know, what we see in the Terminator films and things like this. Like, and so the meaning has almost been changed in social contemporary context, a bit like the word inflation has a different meaning now than what its, you know, technical meaning is. And so when you talk about inflation, you have to actually explain what you mean. And I think there's a lot of principles that, you know, free city advocates, you know, follow, which have similar fates, that the meaning of these has changed either through popular use or even through academia channels.
Or nefarious channels, who knows? Anyway.
Yes.
Uh-huh. It's been a good conversation.
Thanks. I very appreciate you having me on, and yeah, lovely to speak with you.
And glad to see you've got hold of Titus's book. You've got a signed copy down there, I think, haven't you?
Yep, that's coming. That's opening up on the plane ride home tomorrow.
Well, good for you, because I think that you'll find a lot of value in there. And like I say, after that, the next place I would direct you to would be some principles behind seasteading. In particular, just listen to anything Joe Quirk says.
Wonderful.
And in fact, within the next month, I'll be putting out a Joe Quirk interview. It was about 3 hours long, and we cover a lot of a lot of that matter then. But it's a very relevant. It's not even that you should believe in seasteading. It's that you see the principles there becoming a reality.
Yeah, this is what I'm interested in.
Yeah, they're quite radical principles in this day and age. They shouldn't be, but they are quite.
Yeah, they're considered radical.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, they're out of line. You're misstepping if you're talking about them this type
Correct.
Of thing. But yeah, and also, feel free to refer anybody to me if they're interested in these legal principles and how any connection there might be with seasteading or something like that. The more I'm engaged in this world, the more I'm, resonating with the objectives that these people and organizations are trying to achieve.
Well, you can literally reach out to anyone here and they'll definitely get back to you.
It's a very friendly community.
It is a very friendly community. And welcome to it.
Yes.
And thanks for coming in. It's been great talking to you, Scott.
It's mutual. Thank you.